concerned with
moolah.
You don't know how you're supposed to earn it, or what to do with it, or how to keep it. You're a freak with a dark, shameful secret.
But you're not the only one. Hit your hidden financial fears with a blast of sun. Now your healing has begun. It's Bad with Money with Gabby Dunn.
Hello, I'm Gabby Dunn, and this is Bad with Money. Do you remember when we started this show in 2016 and I was all, la, 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 how do you pay off your credit cards? How do you make a bank account? How do you do your student loans? Whatever I was up to, just innocently being like, what's a stock? And now I've aged 1,000 years and we've gone full prison abolition. Welcome. Welcome to the episode, Profiting from Locking People Up. Why do I want to talk about this? Well, because mass incarceration is in the news. Basically, racial justice and criminal justice reform and policing have led to more talk about prisons. And I'm going to go out on a crazy progressive limb here and say that I don't love the idea of people profiting off of putting people into jail and prison. So, I mean, I know this show is ostensibly about me, but it's followed me throughout the years in terms of like how much more sophisticated and in depth I've become on the topics of money. And I just have been obsessively looking into private prisons for the last like month, which I understand is a thing that many people have been doing long before me. And like, welcome to the world, Gabby. Which is why I wanted to talk to investigative reporter Joe Neff from The Marshall Project. The Marshall Project is a nonprofit journalism organization that writes a lot about criminal justice. And so Joe has covered a lot of stuff regarding prisons, especially in the wake of COVID-19, where prisons are some of the biggest incubators for the pandemic. And just, you know, basically how it's impossible to social distance, and also that we don't treat people in jail or prison like human beings. So I had seen a lot of stuff where, you know, they charge prisoners for underwear and shoes, and they charge prisoners for making phone calls, and they charge prisoners for sending emails, which we get into with Joe. And just like the ways in which criminal justice is so punitive rather than correctional, and is also a thriving fucking business, a business. So, okay, yeah, sorry. Here's our interview with the Marshall Project's Joe Neff, who knows a lot more about this than I do. I understand that I am I'm new here. So, can you tell my audience about who you are and what you do, what you write about?
Hi, my name is Joe Neff. I'm an investigative reporter at the Marshall Project. We are a nonprofit newsroom. We cover the criminal justice system and immigration. And for the past couple months, we've been covering COVID-19 and the protests following the killing of George Floyd. And we've just been working our asses off.
Yeah, I'm sure. So what drew you to covering the criminal justice system?
I started off a long time ago. One of my first jobs, I was covering the federal courthouse in Newark, New Jersey, and I just found criminal justice to be an endlessly fascinating subject that gives you such a great and important lens into how our country really works.
When did you start to realize that it was sort of flawed, or that there was a lot to cover, like right away? Or
yeah, right away. I mean, there's so many different beats you can have in medicine, the military, politics, and they all are deep in their own ways. But this, the criminal justice really gives you a sense of who has power in this country and who doesn't. And mm-hmm. what our values, how do we treat our fellow citizens? How do we treat people who aren't citizens? And it's been pretty stark. It's a pretty stark portrait.
Yes. So I was reading some of the reporting on prisons and COVID-19. And basically, I had seen people tweeting about this, but I read a lot of the pieces on the Marshall Project. And basically, there's no social distancing. There's no testing. There's no consideration for the people in prison. And as you said, it is this sort of stark image of like who we value, whose lives we value. So is that kind of, I mean, when you've been covering that, is that what you've been seeing? Like, is that sort of what you've been trying to shed light on?
Oh, absolutely. We knew right when COVID was popping up, if you've ever spent any time in a prison or a jail, you know that their social distancing is impossible. It's that these are facilities that are almost seem to be designed to spread disease in close quarters. And you know that there's staff going in and out every day. And especially in jails, there are people going, getting arrested, bailing out, people going in and out every day. So it's just a perfect system for spreading a disease like this. I was just looking on the New York Times, the top list of the top 10 outbreaks in the country, 9 of them are in prisons.
Right. And that's, I think, something that people don't think about, because I think most people maybe don't know the difference between prison and jail. If you could just for my audience, explain that like briefly.
Okay. So a jail is, in general, you are awaiting trial. It's after your arrest. If you can't afford to bail out, you spend your time in jail before you plead guilty or go to trial. And so jails, you're a lot of traffic in and out. You may spend weeks or months there. Prisons, it's after you've been convicted or pled guilty of a crime, and your time in a prison system is generally measured in years. So you spend a longer time in prison in general, but there's not the churn and burn of a jail.
Prison is such a business. And I think, like, you know, making money off of just insanely high bails. But like, in terms of like, when did prison sort of become like a money-making venture, or like a thing that people could turn a profit from prisons and jails?
Well, we can go back to right after the Civil War, when slavery ends, the black laws come in, and you had convict labor, and a business owner, a farmer, could hire people who were in the local penitentiary or in the jail. And it was almost worse than slavery. At least the plantation owner had an incentive to take good enough care of the enslaved people so that they could work and continue working and laboring for the plantation owner. After the Civil War, this hired convict, the conditions were abysmal, and they could just work people to death, literally, and then just go and hire some more from the local sheriff or the local warden.
Yeah, I think people have this incorrect idea that slavery ended. And what basically happened is they created laws that disproportionately targeted black people and then brought them through the prison system back into slavery, but with even more turnover. And so it did not end in the way that white people seem to think it did.
Correct.
So basically, how does a private prison work as a business?
Okay, now, so private prisons basically started in the 80s. So they're not directly related to what we're just talking about, the hired convict later.
Right.
During the Reagan years, let's turn to a private company because they can manage more than a government entity. How they make money in general is that the state and most prisoners are in state facilities. There's also the federal system, but that's only a couple percentage of prisoners in this country. So a state will pay a private prison company X dollars a day to house a prisoner. And mm-hmm. a couple ways that they make money. One is that staffing. A prison's biggest cost is paying the staff. the correctional officers, the warden, the teachers, the nurse. So that's their big cost. And one of the ways that you can make a lot of money running a private prison is by understaffing. So, and the Marshall Project, we've written a number of stories about this, especially two I wrote about what goes on in Mississippi. So you may have a prison that's supposed to have, let's say, 60 people on every shift. And if you only have 30 people show up for work and you're only paying 30 rather than 60, well, then that's pretty, you can make a lot of money that way by short staffing. And this is a problem at prisons across the country, both public, because even in public prisons, they don't pay enough for people to want to keep these jobs, considering how stressful and unpleasant they can be. But it's especially a big problem in private prisons. So there's a prison I've covered a lot down in the southwest corner of Mississippi, the Wilkinson County Correctional Facility. I've talked to correctional officers there who tell me that the overnight shift, you're supposed to have a minimum of 31 people working the prison at night. And I asked the officers, what's the lowest you've had in terms of staffing on a night shift? Oh, 3 or 6. Yeah, oh, I've heard this from a dozen different correctional officers. So there is a huge problem there with the short staffing and with the and the short staffing. Not only does it make the company more money, but it also makes the prison more dangerous, because you can't run a safe prison with 1,000 medium and maximum security inmates with just 3 or 6 people running the place.
Yeah. I mean, there's like so much to unpack. I'm sorry if I seem scattered all over the place, because I know that there's like, you know, a whole thing on like the use of the labor of the prisoners and like the way that in which we use them to fight fires, for example. And those are prisoners from federal prisons primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And then, which is slave labor, because when they get out, they're not allowed to use the skills they just learned about fighting fires to become a firefighter, which is why. But for private prisons, I mean, they're saving money by not paying. But then what inside the prison, I imagine, becomes complete chaos.
It can come complete chaos, or it can just become a boiling cauldron of frustration and resentment. Because if you only have 6 people watching 1,000 men, the only way to control the situation is to lock down the prison. Put everyone in their cells. And so you have situations where prisoners may not, you know, they'll, instead of getting their out of their cell at least once a day to go to the yard, get some exercise, to take a shower, to go to a class. I've talked with prisoners who just were locked in for weeks at a time. And the food is delivered through a little slot in the door. You get a styrofoam tray of some questionable quality food.
Right.
And you just, if you're locked in your cell with someone that you maybe you're a friend with, or maybe you can't stand, but if you're locked 24 hours a day for weeks at a time, you just imagine how frustrated human beings can get.
Yeah, it's completely dehumanizing. I mean, I was watching a video where it really struck me, where a person was talking about private prisons, and they were like, it's not what you can make money off of, it's what you morally should make money off of. And so, like, who is making money off of this stuff? I Googled the two biggest companies, and their websites were dystopian nightmares. So who is largely turning a profit off this, and how do they, if you interview them or when you talk to them, what's their justification?
Okay. So, a couple things that, private prisons, just to back up slightly, private prisons only contain about 6% of the prisoners in the country. Most mm-hmm. people are locked up by in state systems, where we, the mm-hmm. citizens and the taxpayers, are hiring public servants to run and work in these prisons. So most of them are publicly run. So the way that these big companies respond to questions is generally not at all. I almost never have a face-to-face, let alone a telephone interview with these companies. They're just not responsive to questions. As a reporter, I have to make sure that no one is surprised by anything that's in my story, because that would be unfair. So we end up sending questions, a long list of questions and facts. This is what we have. And if we are wrong on it, let us know if you have any responses. But generally, we don't get our questions answered.
Right.
About what's your justification, or why are you doing this? Is this true?
I feel like it doesn't matter. They're still making a profit. So, but the thing also is that, like, they're also providing detention services. So, like, similar to ICE or like immigration, or, you know, I mean, the go to the websites. I don't know if you, I'll talk shit. You don't have to. CoreCivic and GEO Group. If you go to their websites, the use of euphemisms is real, real cute.
So let me cut you off there on this. Is that the three big
okay.
ones? You're right. CoreCivic, GEO, and a company called MTC, Management and Training Corporation. They're smaller, but those are
okay.
the big three. Now, they not only run prisons, they also run, like you say, detention centers. And they also run halfway houses, where, like, mm-hmm. these smaller facilities that are like a holding tank halfway between being in prison and being out in society.
Right.
So they can make money that way. There's also a whole other private prison industry where companies provide services to the prison. And a lot of these are really, it's monetized, and there's a lot of criticism that has been leveled at these companies. For example, inmate phone calls. If someone wants to contact their loved one inside prison, they have to sign up with whichever company, it's usually Global Tellink or JPay, to make phone calls. And it costs. And you sign up for an account, and you have to pay for phone calls. You have to pay. You can, if you want to send emails out, you have to pay for the emails. If you want to do a video visitation, which is actually an industry term, it's not a visitation, it's just a video call, you have to pay for it. And you can, the deeper that you go into these variety of contracts, so much of the services in prisons have been privatized. A company makes
even
meals.
In federal prisons.
Oh yeah, in federal prisons, in state prisons, in county jails.
Right.
So you'll have a company that maybe is hired to cook and serve the food, the three meals a day. That company also may have the vending machines and commissary. If you're revolted by crummy prison food, or there's not mm-hmm. enough of it, then you can go to the commissary or vending machines and buy your crackers with peanut butter,
yeah.
snacks and peanut butter or ramen. You can buy you know, shoes or slippers to wear, or underwear, or shampoo or soap. All of that is sold to the inmates, to the prisoners, and usually the money comes out of their families. You know, that they families fill the commissary account so that the prisoner can buy these things to get by.
Well, this is a racist scam. Okay, so who, let's get into that. So who is largely targeted to fill these prisons? Because I was reading about, you know, that they make a certain amount of money per bed. And like, is this like, it's, it, I mean, everyone knows that it's like disproportionately people of color, specifically Black people in prison, correct?
Yeah, Black and people of color, Latinx, make up a disproportionate amount of people locked up in prisons and jails. There's plenty of white people in prison and jails too, but they're not. They're represented less than you know, their percentage of American population.
And I imagine class-wise, the white people that are in prison are lower income people. That's just my guess.
In general, having money means that you can afford a good lawyer or a lawyer at all, and not an overworked
right.
public defender. So, sure, class definitely
right.
is an issue.
Okay, we need to take a quick break and we'll be right back. And we're back. So people are profiting off mass incarceration of mostly people of color. Obviously, there's protests going on for racial justice. Like, how is this being incorporated into the conversation? Because I'm having a little bit of like a disconnect that I was talking about on Twitter yesterday, where it's like, you know, obviously we want to arrest the cops who killed Breonna Taylor. We want to arrest the cops who killed Elijah McClain, things like that. But they're going then into a system that is, you know, doesn't jive with like prison abolition, which is something that I've become more and more interested in. So like, how are you seeing in reporting, or what you've been reporting on, like, how are these conversations mashing together, if they are at all?
Well, they're just the threads of conversations about criminal justice, about prisons, about policing. They're just there are thousands of different ways that it can go. I think that what's helpful when thinking about policing, when thinking about prisons, is what is the core function here? What is policing about? Is it about control, or is it about keeping people safe and keeping a vibrant community? Do the people that they protect as their neighbor, or do they perceive them as their enemy? I mean, I think that
right.
most people would agree that, well, we want to have a safe community where we're, you know, we're neighbors and we can all get along and live good, productive, creative lives. But if you have an us versus them mentality, and a lot of police training there's this whole school of programs that teach police to be warriors. Well, then your
right.
police are civilians, as are you and I and everyone mm-hmm. else. And I don't know if we should be going to war on civilians. The police aren't at war with civilians. Police should be protecting and making the whole community a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
It's helpful too to pull away. What's the mission of police? Is it if you talk to police, or you talk to, especially you talk to any county sheriff. County sheriff has a jail full of people, and every sheriff I have ever talked to will say, we're supposed to care for, there's so many people in here who are homeless, who suffer from addiction. Well, we're not substance abuse counselors here. We're not trained psychologists. We have people who are mentally ill. We are not mental health providers. There is so much that the county sheriff has to provide in services that they're just not cut out to do, and they're not funded to do enough. So I think the conversation should be about who is best suited to, at least when it comes to policing, to respond to calls. Most calls are not about a murder or violent crime. It's about, I'm sick, maybe someone in the household is having a psychotic episode, or their parent and child, or partner and partner. Yeah, there's probably a lot, a way to provide those, to respond to those calls that are, do not need someone to show up in a uniform with a gun who's trained, who's not trained to be a social worker or a mental health worker. And the other one, when it comes to prisons, what is the point of prisons? They call them correctional facilities or places of rehabilitation, but there's precious little correction going on in so many, or rehabilitation in so many of the prisons in this country. It's punitive, it's underfunded, it's understaffed, and it's not good for the people locked up, and it's not healthy for the people who are locking them up, either physically or emotionally. And in a lot of places in Europe, the idea, and especially in Northern Europe, the idea of a prison is to prepare someone to rejoin the community. How do we get this person into a place where they're a productive and happy member of the community? And there's precious little of that going on in our country. There is some, but that's not the rule.
Yeah, prison is largely, I think, in people's minds focused on like justice, quote unquote, which is actually sort of like revenge. And then, you know, I think they're filled with people who have committed very small crimes. And also, like, because, you know, when you start talking about prison reform or prison abolition or like, correction or reform or like teaching people or whatever, everyone's like picturing in their mind like a vampire rapist or something. Like they're not picturing like fellow human beings, which I think is the problem. And also the problem is that like it's an industry. Like you're making an industry of this. It's making money.
It's a big industry. Like, it is.
It's huge. I was looking at, before Trump was elected, the stock sort of plummeting in these companies, and then there being pressure for banks and other places to divest from private prisons. And then I saw that basically they just go to international banks. Like I think the thing I read mentioned Japan. Is that sort of like, is there some sort of like backlash on like, okay, we have to, you know, this is either costing the government money, or, oh, we're losing investments in private prisons. So like, how are we gonna, you know, like, how are we going to make this profitable? Or like, is there some sort of awakening of, you know, either public pressure to not do it, or like awakening of like, oh, maybe this is bad?
Well, it's a complicated landscape. I mean, first of all, the private prison companies, and the private prison supply companies who sell the snacks or provide healthcare or phone, they hire lobbyists, and they also give a lot of money in political contributions. And if you're looking to get, contracts in a state, whether it's, Oregon or, Alabama or Nebraska, it's not that hard to go to the state capitol, meet the right legislators and convince them that you've got the best product and you're going to save the state money. And, that's an issue with the fact that we have 50 different state correctional systems where most of the people are locked up in. As far as the banks that are lending, if a prison company has a lucrative contract, they're going to be able to find financing somehow. Sometimes it's bank loans. Sometimes they can issue bonds. The two big companies, CoreCivic and Geo, are both organized as REITs, real estate investment trusts, which have this great tax advantage. As long as you repay 90% of your earnings each year to your shareholders, you basically have a very low tax load. And it's complicated, and given the current financial crash, due to the pandemic.
Yeah.
This is not the REIT structure for these two big companies is kind of in danger for them right now. It's complicated, but it's a troublesome model for them right now. But I think the one of the things that we as citizens can do is raise the question, why are we locking up so many people? How much is it costing us? You know, we cost $40,000 to keep someone in a Pennsylvania prison a year, while you could send that person to community college for $6,000 a year. You could send them to a full-blown state school for maybe $18,000 a year. You know, what would be a better investment for our country in the long run? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think, why are we doing this? And it's not just the actual number cost, that $42,000 a year. All of these have what economists like to say opportunity costs. We're paying to lock someone up and they're not out there working, making money, supporting a family and paying taxes. So the cost is actually a lot higher.
As capitalist and cynical as that is, yeah.
Well, it doesn't have to be capitalist. It could be democratic socialist. Don't we want people to have jobs? Don't we want them to contribute to help pay for roads and schools and healthcare and arts and parks and things? Yeah,
for sure. I mean, so obviously, if they're just looking to cut costs and they don't care about people, and also like that, I think the society at large has this very wrong idea that everyone in prison is violent and that everyone in prison is out to get them specifically, or whatever people think. Like with COVID, I mean, is it just that it just doesn't, it's cost, it would cost too much money to take, to do anything about that in prisons, to it would cost too much money or be too much of an inconvenience to like do anything in terms of stopping the huge outbreaks that are happening?
Well, one of the things that we could do that would actually save money would be to start letting a lot of people out. I'm talking to you from North Carolina, has about 30,000 state inmates. About 1,200 of them at the time when COVID started coming here were on work release. These are prisoners who we trust to go out in the community, catch a bus, drive to work, go to work in the governor's mansion, or go to work at the chicken plant. We trust them to go out in society every day. By definition, they could be out in the free world. Bingo, 1,200 people that you could let out. You have all sorts of people who are, the prison populations are aging. In the 90s, we went on this tough on crime binge, and we made longer sentences for more crime. So you have a prison population in this country that is much older than it used to be. And what is the utility of locking up old people? It's the research bears it out. Most of prisoners are men. Women, unfortunately, when it comes to crime, don't do their fair share. So there's all these men in prison, and it's
sorry, that was funny. Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. The men in prison. It's shown that as you age, your risk of committing crime really reduces. The testosterone levels go down. The frontal cortex of the brain matures by age 25. And why are we locking up hundreds of thousands of people in their 50s and 60s? Now, some of these people, if you go on an individual basis, I wouldn't want to let them out, given their criminal histories. But by and large, as people age, they just age out of criminal conduct. And so, why are we having all these old people? And it's expensive to lock them up. Why not let them out and have them find jobs and regain a life?
Yeah, and criminal conduct. I mean, I think criminal conduct is a big umbrella where, like, I think people are envisioning, like, murderers and rapists and pedophiles, and, like, maybe this person, like, robbed a store or, like, you know, I think we're talking about people who are, like, largely nonviolent, or, you know, maybe their violence was against property.
Yeah. Well, there's plenty of, you know, of violent crime. Assault is a problem. Domestic violence is a problem. But then sometimes the other thing is how much of what's actually driving the crime. Is it
right?
Is it property? Is it substance abuse that you know is supporting a habit?
Yeah.
Is it poverty? Trying to put, especially for women, keeping food on the table for children, is an issue. Is it domestic violence in the way that so many women who are in prison are just kind of following their poorly chosen partner in his life of crime or in his scam or in, you know, so.
They're being abused. They're being manipulated.
Right. So it's the question to ask is, there's that saying, you know, if your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. What is the problem that puts people into, violating our norms and violating our laws? And what's the best way to work to help them get out of that?
Okay, it's time for one last break, and then we'll be right back. And we're back. So obviously, like you talked about, different states having different systems. And political parties are divided, where I think a lot of really progressive candidates were talking about banning private prisons. And then that may have hurt them in terms of like donations and stuff like that. Like how is it divided? What's the division in political parties or states on the issue of private prisons?
Well, in general, the Democratic Party is much less in favor of private prisons. President Obama in 2016 announced that the phasing out, federal government wouldn't use private prisons anymore. President Trump was elected, and as you mentioned before, the stock in CoreCivic and Geo went up overnight. The Republican Party in general has been more hospitable to private prisons. But there is a movement among conservative politicians, among evangelicals, among more libertarian politicians that want people to get out and become good employees and become good citizens, and they don't see that private prisons are helping that. And B, there's especially among libertarians and that there is a distrust of government. And so if government is going to lock you up for violating the law, they have to prove it, and then they have to carry out their obligations. Privatizing core functions of justice, like depriving someone of liberty by putting them in prison, is awful, scary to many, many people, both on the right and left. Should you privatize these core functions of justice and liberty? Would we privatize our military? Would we just say, hey, let's just get rid of the Department of Defense and hire companies to go fight wars for us? So I just think that that is the argument against private prisons that I hear from all parts of the political spectrum. Should we privatize justice? Should we make build monetary incentives that the more money that a company can make more money by doing things like short staffing, or in many states you can't get out. Some states you can't get out of prison until you get a GED, and if the private prison doesn't offer the services or drags out the services, then you can't get out of prison until you get your GED. So, to have some of these incentives that are built into the private correctional system are perverse at best.
That's a great way of putting it. Just briefly before we end, I wanted to ask about, you mentioned Trump and the system changing. And I know that private prisons have been used more as ICE detention centers. Can you talk about that a little bit, about like that, I guess, under Trump, that being used more for like immigration detention and increased immigration detention? Although, to be fair, it was happening under Obama.
Oh, it's if you go to the Marshall Project, we have a really good documentary we did on the history of immigration and detention, done by my colleague Emily Cassie. So, Obama and Bush and Clinton before had turned to more detention to stop people or who are arrested after crossing into the United States. But it's really taken off under Trump, and the private detention companies, the same ones who run private prisons, GEO and CoreCivic, have gotten a lot of business running these detention centers. And there's other private entities that do so as well. And so this is it's a profitable business for these companies. And one of the problems with the detention centers, as with prisons and jails, is that they're cut off from society. It's not easy to see what's happening inside a detention center or prison. When you know, police, we get a sense of what they do because they're out on the street. They're in a car. We see them arresting people. We see them at providing security at a parade or whatever. They do their work mostly in public. What goes on in a prison or detention facility, the public has very little insight into what's going on there because it's behind barbed wires, it's behind walls, and we just don't know what goes on in there. And I think that's a fundamental issue.
So what can people do if they want, other than obviously going to the Marshall Project and reading all of your stuff, what can people do if they're like, hey, wait a minute, this sucks?
Well, I think that if people are unhappy with how our government is functioning, you know, we're the taxpayers, we're the voters. If we don't like what's going on, then you go out and you vote. And it starts, the police are a city function. So that's your city councilman and the mayor. The sheriff's a county function. Your county commissioners, you know, in general, run the jails. And the state prison system is run by and funded and the laws are made by our local representatives. So if you don't like something that's going on in society, you can go out and vote for someone who will change what you don't like. And that is, I think, fundamentally the politics at the local city and county level and at the state level are, if you're at all concerned about the criminal justice system, that's where your vote is absolutely important.
And if there's voter suppression, then I don't know. everything's bad. Well, thank you so much. And I think a lot of people, if you guys are interested, please go to the Marshall Project and please read Joe Neff's articles, and everybody's articles of the Marshall Project. It's a fantastic website and organization. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, the MarshallProject.org. And just to say one last footnote, just to make sure that we are all reporters at the Marshall Project. We have a couple fundraisers. We're not advocates. We feel that the way to fix things is to provide more information, shed more light, to bring things out into plain sight. So we don't advocate for any policy or another, or one or another, but we do want to expose how the system works to the world. That's our goal.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Enjoyed it.
Obviously, I could have talked to Joe Neff all day. I think that was clear. I was a little bit all over the place in terms of like what I wanted to talk about, because I wanted to talk about so much. And I think like if you go back and read his pieces, I mean, it's pretty clear that prison itself was born out of slavery, and it was born out of keeping slavery going. Depending on what school you go to, if you learn about this or not, but laws were created specifically to target Black people to put them back into the system wherein they could be made to keep working for free. And it doesn't take someone who studied this to know that Black and Latinx people are disproportionately targeted for imprisonment and for nonviolent crimes. And even, you know, Joe mentioned for somewhat violent crimes, for mental health issues, for, you know, things that people could be rehabilitated for, that they're just thrown away by society. And we really need to rethink what we believe prison, federal or private, is for, and who is profiting off of it, and who is making money off of it. Because the idea that this type of thing is a business here, when in other countries it's not, cough, cough, healthcare as well. Oh God, don't cough. You'll end up with millions of dollars in hospital bills. The point is, not everything has to make a goddamn profit. And the things that do, like, just take a second and be like, why? Thank you for listening. Make sure you've subscribed to our show on Stitcher or wherever you find your podcasts. The show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Our audio engineer is Brendan Burns, and our audio is mixed by Andy Christens. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon and Josephine Martirana. Original music is composed by Zach Sherwin, Mike Kaplan, and Jack Dolgen. Our theme song is performed by Sam Barbera. Bad With Money is a production of Stitcher. I'm Gabby Dunn, and I will see you next week.